From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is away. I'm Bob Garfield. The news from Afghanistan this week was grim. With the deaths of four U.S. soldiers in a bombing incident, 2009 became the bloodiest year for NATO forces since Afghanistan operations began in late 2001. The resurgence of the Taliban and escalating violence led Joint Chiefs Chairman Michael Mullen to characterize the security situation as, quote, serious and deteriorating. The Pentagon, meanwhile, persists in its attempts to have two wars portrayed in the best possible light. Stars and Stripes, the editorially independent newspaper serving the armed forces worldwide, reported this week that the military is in effect screening journalists who wish to embed with troops. Triggered in part by an interview on this program, Stars and Stripes confirmed that a Washington PR firm has provided evaluations of reporters' relative degrees of positivity. Howard Witt is senior managing editor of Stars and Stripes, and he joins me now. Howard, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Summarize, please, the story you printed this week.
We ourselves have run into problems with the embed system. A couple of months ago, one of our reporters was barred from an embed in Mosul in Iraq, and the stated reason from the Army public affairs people was because he failed to highlight good news. And then with some further investigation last week and this week, we came to find out that there's actual profiles that are commissioned of every reporter who is assigned or seeks to be embedded with the military. These profiles are done by this Washington-based PR firm called the Rendon Group. And so these profiles basically look at a reporter's past work, whether it's positive, negative, or neutral. They lay it all out in a pie chart, give the reporter a rating. And then they also give some very specific recommendations as to how best to manipulate that reporter's coverage in terms of the kind of places you might embed that reporter. So it seems like a pretty dramatic attempt on the part of the military to steer this process.
Now, the military has told you that you're misunderstanding the role of the Rendon Group, that it's simply to help commanders on the ground accommodate the needs of reporters. Do you buy that?
I know that's what they say, but we're in possession of several of these profiles, and they seem to go a lot further than that. They say things like, in light of so-and-so's past interest in covering the soldier's view of stories, providing him the opportunity to cover the positive work of a successful operation could result in favorable coverage. Then they also said about a reporter from one of America's most preeminent newspapers, they said the sentiment in his articles is generally neutral to positive. Given that neutral to positive sentiment, one can expect so-and-so to produce coverage that is at least neutral in sentiment and representative of the military point of view of events. They said that possible negative coverage that this reporter might provide could, quote, possibly be neutralized by providing military official quotes about the topic, blah, blah, blah. So these things, they don't seem to be quite as innocent as the Pentagon is saying that they are.
I want to get back to the experience that Stars and Stripes had with its own reporter, Heath Druzan, who had been embedded with a unit in Iraq and reapplied for another embed tour and was denied amid some fairly nasty allegations by the Army.
They came up with a whole bunch of allegations many weeks after the fact. No complaint about his coverage was ever raised with us at the time the stories were written. But when he reapplied for an embed several months later with the same unit, he was denied. And when he and we pressed for an explanation, we were given a whole bunch of different reasons. They ranged from he tried to use a computer when he wasn't authorized. He attempted to report on the names of some dead soldiers before they were officially released by the Pentagon. He failed to highlight the good news about the unit's activities. We summarily and vigorously denied the basis of all of these claims. For instance, it's our policy to never report the names of a deceased soldier before the next of kin in the Army has officially made its announcement. We do that as a matter of policy and also as a matter of morality. The idea that he failed to highlight good news, the specifics of that allegation as they were relayed to us, was that he dared to talk to some actual Iraqis in Mosul and get their impression about whether they thought the American troops were a helpful presence there. And he collected a whole bunch of quotes from people who said, no, they didn't think they were. And that infuriated the Army commanders and appears to have been the real basis for why they denied the embassy. bed. And again, we completely reject that the Army has the right to do that, and we wrote about it.
Now, in a moment, we're going to speak to a public affairs spokesman for the Army in Afghanistan. And I have no doubt that she will say, well, the fact that so much bad news has emanated from both Iraq and Afghanistan in stories by embedded reporters is proof that the military has only the best interests of reporters in mind, putting aside a couple of tempests in a teapot. Is this a tempest in a teapot?
You might say that the reason that all of that news got out might have been in spite of the military's attempts to suppress it. But no, this is not a tempest in a teapot. These profiles are being compiled, apparently, on every reporter who embeds. This morning over at the Pentagon, all the military reporters were demanding to see their own profiles. I'm told that, for instance, CNN's Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr got hers and was incensed. This is a systematic effort, or at least has been, on the part of the military to monitor and attempt to manipulate what reporters are doing.
No, I think the general public may often misunderstand Stars and Stripes' relationship with the military, that it's, you know, some sort of propaganda mouthpiece, not understanding that it's editorially independent. Do you think the Pentagon itself sometimes doesn't understand that Stars and Stripes is not a house organ?
They absolutely misunderstand that. We're constantly getting complaints from commanders that somehow we're not towing the party line. And our polite but firm answer is, no, we're not, and we never will. That is not our job. Our job is to be an independent source of news for the men and women who are risking their lives for America overseas.
Howard, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Howard Witt is Senior Managing Editor of Stars and Stripes. Lieutenant Commander Christine Seidenstricker is spokesperson for the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Lieutenant Commander, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
The military told Stars and Stripes it hasn't vetted or graded reporters for at least a year. Stars and Stripes has documents that shows that the Rendon Group was grading reporters at least as recently as May. What's true?
There's actually a couple of things to correct even right there. We've never graded reporters, and the information we get from Rendon doesn't do so. The information we were contracted with them to provide is basic biographical detail and the past stories reporters have done. Now, sometimes those do include a positive, negative, or neutral rating, which we do get. Frankly, we don't use that information. One of the premises of the Stars and Stripes story was that we take this information and then decide whether to allow them to embed or cover operations. And that is flat out incorrect. That has never been Department of Defense policy. It has never been U.S. Forces Afghanistan policy. And any time there have been instances of individual public affairs officers making that mistake, that has been corrected immediately.
You know, if it is not meant to grade a reporter on how friendly he is potentially or her to the unit, why pay an outside PR firm to create neutral, negative, and positive sentiment ratings to begin with?
That is a piece of information that's included in those reports, but it's not the primary thing we've asked for from Rendon. They are analyzing media coverage trends, and that's not individual reporters. That's overall what's being reported on given issues, measuring the effectiveness of our own communications, and also measuring the effectiveness of our events by tracking which are covered by news media and which aren't. It also includes whether media reporting is accurate. That's information we're much more interested in. The positive, neutral, and negative, I can tell you, I've never actually seen used for anything here.
Well, then let me ask you about the Heath Druzin case. He is the Stars and Stripes reporter who covered operations of the 1st Cavalry Division's 3rd Heavy Brigade Combat Team in February and March, but was not permitted to rejoin the unit for another reporting tour because, quote, according to his dossier, despite the opportunity to visit areas of the city where Iraqi army leaders, soldiers, national police, and Iraqi police displayed commitment to partnership, Mr. Druzin refused to highlight any of this news.
That was in Iraq, correct?
That was in Iraq, and it was from a public affairs officer. Is that not a smoking gun that demonstrates the military is seeking to manipulate coverage?
Absolutely not. Let me say that. DoD policy is absolutely not to try to shape coverage by denying access to reporters who don't portray operations favorably. I can tell you that in every instance I've seen where something like that has happened, the commands have said, that's not how we operate. We are not here to evaluate pass coverage and deny or grant access based on that.
Lieutenant Commander, if the commanders were not expected to act on the information provided by Rendon Group, then why are they given the information to begin with? It would seem to me that the commanders in the field have wars to fight and should have nothing to do with the embedded reporters other than protecting operational security. Why do they have any kind of PR mission at all?
There is no PR mission. The public affairs mission for the Department of Defense is to facilitate access to information to the extent that we can do so without compromising security. If we truly had a policy of not embedding reporters with a history of negative coverage, you wouldn't see the coverage you see. I think if you look at many of the reporters we've embedded, many, many of them are very critical of operations and commanders in the administration. The facts just do not support the idea that we are denying access as a matter of policy based on past coverage.
Except when the facts do support that idea.
I don't think the facts ever support that idea.
So my final question for you is this then. If the Rendon Group is providing information on reporters, including their historical accuracy in theater, and if mistakes have happened, do you not see a direct connection between the availability of these dossiers and the tendency for public affairs officers and operational commanders to act against the written policy?
I don't. The facts just don't support that. We, as a matter of course, provide a great deal of access to reporters wishing to embed, and the policy is very clear. Public affairs officers are definitely aware of it. When mistakes are made, they're dealt with.
All right. Lieutenant Commander, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Commander Christine Seidenstricker is a spokesperson for the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. We spoke to her from Kabul. As of Friday, according to the Pentagon, the reporter profiling program was, quote, under review. No formal inquiry into the program has been launched. Coming up, if reporters cover the debate over the efficacy of torture, have they already taken sides? This is On the Media from NPR.
Hi, Jesse Thorne here, host and producer of The Sound of Young America. Our show's been such a successful podcast that some people don't know that it's also a nationally syndicated public radio show. As such, I'm obligated to ask deep, probing questions, even of young, starry-eyed comedians like John Mulaney.
Should we fight?
Huh?
I think we should fight.
Should we break a broomstick in half and just go at it?
Just go to town!
Yeah, I could never fight you, though, because you are a fellow sufferer of babyface old radio voice.
Yeah!
Which we're both afflicted with.
Check out The Sound of Young America and a whole bunch of other podcasts at MaximumFun.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The CIA Inspector General's report issued Monday was long-awaited and predictably explosive. Despite claims to the contrary by former Vice President Dick Cheney, the CIA's own analysis demonstrated no clear link between the torture of terrorism suspects and valuable intelligence. This was page one news everywhere and widely reported as a repudiation of the Bush administration's rationale for so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. But we wondered if the coverage didn't, in a backhand way, validate a spurious justification for torture. Greg Miller covers intelligence for the LA Times, and he joins me now. Greg, welcome to OTM.
Thanks very much.
Your story on Wednesday said there was, quote, little or no evidence to support Dick Cheney's claim that interrogators extracted key information using waterboarding and other torture tactics. That was the gist of the piece, correct?
Yeah, it was essentially that there was a good deal of intelligence that came from CIA prisoners, but that there is very little in these documents to suggest that specific methods were crucial or even necessary for getting that information.
My follow-up is, so what? Let's just say that the CIA report had concluded that torture had, in fact, extracted key intelligence, that Dick Cheney was correct in asserting that torture works. Then what? Where does that take us?
You're not going to get me to argue that waterboarding is legal or that there are situations in which waterboarding ought to be okay or that it's not torture. But there's a continuum of methods here, ranging from the deprivation of sleep up to waterboarding. And I think it would be foolish to think that this is an issue that is not going to resurface for some future administration. I've been told that in a conversation with senior officials at the White House, CIA Director Mike Hayden, who was replaced when Obama was elected, on his way out of office, put the question this way: are you guys sure about this? Are you sure that there are no circumstances in which you are going to be willing to disrupt the sleep cycle of a detainee that you think has relevant and critical threat information? History has shown us that brutal interrogation tactics have popped up time and again in times of war and in times of national crisis. And so trying to evaluate what works and what doesn't is part of what it might be necessary to inform that debate the next time it comes around.
I grant you that there is a continuum of techniques, and I also further grant you that there may be a continuum of circumstance. And, you know, I'm going to also further grant you, Greg, that I probably shouldn't be picking on you particularly, because certainly this week the preponderance of your reporting has concerned the brutality of the interrogations. But over the past number of months, at least four times, you have taken up the subject of efficacy. And I have to therefore ask you, isn't any reporting on the intelligence pros and cons of torture changing the subject in exactly the way that Dick Cheney wants it changed, from the morality and legality of torture to the efficacy of torture? Aren't you kind of being suckered by your very reporting validating the premise that effectiveness constitutes justification?
I sure hope not. Dick Cheney commands a great deal of attention on these issues, and I think part of our role in the press is to evaluate the assertions of public officials who have an ability to influence the public. And so some of these stories I've written have challenged these assertions Cheney has made. He said a month or two ago that the interrogations of these prisoners saved hundreds of thousands of lives, and that just seemed to be an astonishing assertion, and it seemed to warrant some scrutiny. And while Cheney is obviously a really important figure in the debate on this issue, there are other elements of it. The Senate Intelligence Committee is in the midst of a major study of this question. They're gathering millions of pages of documents from the CIA to look at whether these tactics were necessary, whether they worked. And this is being driven by a senator, Dianne Feinstein, who is adamantly opposed to using anything beyond the sort of basic interrogation approaches. This is a debate that is happening with or without my participation. I don't regard myself as a participant in this debate. My job is to challenge the assertions of public officials like Dick Cheney and uncover facts that are important for the public to know.
You just said something interesting, that you don't want to be part of the discussion. You just want to report on it. I'm paraphrasing. But if a phony controversy falls in the forest and no news organization decides to pay attention, does it exist? Is it never right for a news organization to say they're hanging their hat on a logical irrelevancy and therefore we don't really need to pay attention?
I guess I don't see this issue falling into that category. Finding myself trying to think of a case in which the nature of a subject requires us not to cover it. I mean, I guess there have clearly been cases in history where the press has been co-opted, you know, by McCarthyism. ultimately, the press, in I think many cases, ends up being the tool to challenge those sorts of abuses of power. But because of the importance of this issue, I think that it's hard to argue that writing about the different facets of this, and as we've talked about, there is the debate over whether it's right and wrong, and there is a debate over whether it works or not. I don't think giving the public more information on this issue is a bad thing to do.
You know, now you've caught me in kind of a funny situation, because I guess I seem even to myself to be suggesting that the press conspire to suppress a debate if it does consider it irrelevant. But is there no way to frame the debate to make clearer the notion that the Bush administration's justification for torture is still illegal, effective or not?
We've given a good deal of attention to that point. In the story that I wrote this week, in fact, I said that President Obama has said that the use of these methods is not only illegal, but made the country less safe because of how much ill will it generates towards Americans to be seen employing brutal tactics like this. I'm always trying to frame this in this context, that this is a difficult issue and that this is something that many people regard as immoral, and that this isn't merely a debate over whether they worked or not.
Well, Greg, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Greg Miller is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and co-author of The Interrogators: Inside the Secret War Against Al-Qaeda. Is it ethical for reporters to misrepresent themselves to get a story? What if they unearth injustice or corruption on a massive scale? In a piece we originally aired last fall, Brooke reported on the ethics of the much acclaimed and much criticized practice of undercover reporting.
Reporters often have to wade through a river of ethical dilemmas, and when they're working undercover, that river can become a swamp. Even their colleagues don't approve of what they're doing, and their targets. Well, here's a clip we found on YouTube of what happened when an NBC Dateline reporter working undercover at DEF CON, a conference of underground hackers, was unmasked.
I'm not cool with that, especially when they turn down the opportunity to get a press badge. So, I need a show of hands, a new contest, spot the undercover reporter.
A crowd of jeering hackers followed as she bolted from the building.
Thanks for playing!
To catch a reporter!
Come back next year.
Give our love to the editors!
Harper's Magazine has just released an anthology called Submersion Journalism, Reporting in the Radical First Person. It's a collection of Harper's articles reported more or less undercover. It's a tricky genre involving some degree of deception, ranging from merely not disclosing that you're a reporter to outright lying and fakery. Washington Post and CNN media critic Howard Kurtz is not a fan, but
I don't think we have to go around with a bullhorn saying, press here, please let me in so that I can expose your wrongdoing. But I think there is a very significant step, a gap, between doing that and between taking on a fake name, fake business card, fake profession in order to go after what might be a very worthwhile story, but you're still lying to get it.
Here Kurtz is referring to a particular Harper's story in which writer Ken Silverstein donned a new suit and a pair of fake glasses, printed some business cards, and passed himself off as a consultant looking to hire a Washington lobbying firm to spruce up the rep of the hellaciously repressive nation of Turkmenistan. He found a couple of takers, happy to charge upwards of $1 million to seed the press and cozy up to congressmen. Silverstein named names and took some hits, as he told us in June of 2007.
I think there's a slight irony in some ways to the criticism of the undercover tactic in this case. I mean, to me, you know, it's okay for these lobbying firms to plant op-eds and to create bogus news events and to manipulate the media. But it's not okay for me to expose their dirty linen. I find that somewhat ironic.
Is it usually bad for a reporter to lie? Sure.
Harper's senior editor Bill Wasik edited Submersion Journalism.
But in the case of Washington lobbying for foreign dictatorships, we felt like that this was an instance where it was justified for Ken to create this identity to go and get a story that he wouldn't have been able to get through any other means.
And Wasik says it received an overwhelmingly positive response. Readers pay attention when reporters go undercover. Consider Silverstein's career, says Brooke Kroger, director of the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute at New York University.
You look back at his record, he has written about 20 pieces about Washington lobbyists since 1995, either for the Los Angeles Times or for the Harper's. Over 20 pieces. What he told me was that this is the only one that ever got serious, significant attention, a spotlight put on this issue.
Kroger wrote a biography of one of history's greatest undercover reporters called Nellie Bly, Daredevil Reporter Feminist.
She, in her very famous insane asylum expose, spent 10 days inside as someone who was deranged and came out to write about it in a huge two-part series that had just momentous impact and caused new monies to be brought into that facility.
Starting around 1887, Bly went undercover for a spectacular series of exposés. She spawned legions of imitators, and the practice persists to this day. Well, there was that controversial case in the 90s that looked as if it might kill undercover reporting for good when a jury found that ABC News had committed fraud when its reporters faked their resumes to work at the Food Lion grocery chain. The network was slapped with a $5.5 million fine. Here's ABC spokesperson Eileen Murphy after the ruling in 1997.
Food Lion has succeeded in convincing a jury to punish ABC for using undercover techniques that exposed its unsanitary practices. The company did so without ever challenging the truth of our broadcast, and we're obviously troubled by that.
2 years later, the ruling was overturned, though some critics did claim ABC had faked some footage, which ABC denied. The issue is one of trust. And in an age of famous fakers like the New York Times' Jason Blair and the New Republic's Stephen Glass, trust in journalism has been leaking like air from a punctured balloon. Howard Kurtz.
There's a long and colorful history of these undercover investigations, and often they do have a payoff that exposes some sort of dastardly conditions in factories or unclean conditions in restaurants or you name it. But I think that in modern journalism, that's a luxury we can no longer afford.
In many instances, it's the only way to get the story.
Pam Zekman is an investigative reporter for Chicago's CBS affiliate.
And if the abuse is extensive enough and affects enough people, it's justified so long as you don't break the law and you don't hurt anybody in the process.
For years, she reported for the Chicago Sun-Times, and she often went undercover to expose a wrong, most notably in a 25-part series that ran in 1978, centered on a little bar called The Mirage in Chicago.
But it could be almost any neighborhood tavern, any place.
Mike Wallace narrating a 60 Minutes report on the story.
Actually, it's a story of corruption in city government. Inspectors on the take, bribed to overlook health, building, and fire code violations. Kickbacks, tax evasion. Well, several months ago, some investigators and a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times set out to determine for themselves how many of those rumors were fact in their city.
That would be Zekman, who said that small business owners were hurting but were afraid to go public.
And we had to, in order to prove this, become them.
The Mirage was, in fact, a mirage, a bar set up by the Chicago Sun-Times. When its doors opened, the crooks poured in, taking bribes in envelopes or directly from the register, all on camera. The celebrated series was up for a Pulitzer Prize, but was stymied by Pulitzer board member Ben Bradley of the Washington Post, who disapproved of undercover journalism. Zekman finds it frankly amusing. Now, since the Post had won a Pulitzer a few years earlier for Watergate, which relied on anonymous sources, a practice she believes is every bit as problematic as going undercover, if not more so.
I have always been a believer that the undercover technique, when there's no other way to get the story, is a truer way of getting at what's happening in an abusive area and a more credible way for the viewer or for the reader because they can see and hear what's happening. They don't have to trust that these anonymous sources exist. They don't have to make that leap of faith.
At least when a reporter goes undercover, you know who to trust or who not to. Harper's Bill Wasik.
When we do these first-person narrative stories, the writer comes back and essentially has to convince the reader through just an act of great writing and great journalism that what they've seen says something very important about the future of the nation or the future of the economy or technology or what have you. And so in terms of trust, it's a process that has to be built up every time.
Wasik says Harper's undercover reporters aim not so much to expose individuals as to slip past otherwise impenetrable public relations barricades to show how the world really works. Others do troll for individual evildoers, like NBC's Chris Hansen, who works with the police and uses human decoys to catch a predator.
You heard that right. Wants to take someone he thinks is a 12-year-old to a hotel for sex. But the decoy won't budge, so Cisneros gives in and shows up at the house. And he comes prepared.
So what are you doing? Did you bring condoms?
Yeah.
Sweet.
Hansen strides in, pad in hand.
I'm Chris Hansen. and I want to ask you some questions. Please have a seat.
Score.
That, for me, goes a little bit too far.
Journalist and author Brooke Kroger.
An argument could be made that law enforcement is set up to do some of those things. Is that really the role of a reporter?
So what is the role? To always be truthful to everyone, no matter who, no matter what? Former Chicago Tribune editor and publisher Jack Fuller is an absolutist.
We don't deceive our readers, and we don't deceive people we deal with, even if from time to time you end up missing a story as a result of it.
But Nellie Bly could not have exposed corruption and abuse and man's inhumanity to man without deceit. Sometimes a fake name is a ticket to a dark world of injustice desperate for the light of day.
Well, that's the best argument in favor of it. The best argument against it is that you have truth tellers lying. That's dangerous. I mean, that's the choice people have to make. You know, it's not an easy one. It's a judgment call.
The Washington Post's Dana Priest did not identify herself as a reporter to the authorities at Walter Reed Medical Center as she investigated horrific conditions there. But she did reveal herself to everyone she interviewed. She won a Pulitzer. How about Ted Conover, who revealed himself to no one when serving as a prison guard at Sing Sing for his widely admired book, New Jack? Mr. Fuller?
If they identified themselves by their own names and they never told an untruth, then I would have no problem with it.
And maybe it helps to suffer over your decision, like Ted Conover.
He tried every other possible way to do that story, but felt it was very, very important to get inside of.
Brooke Kroger.
So he approaches this with the right kind of agony, I think, and that makes his work very powerful.
Coming up in a moment, we'll hear from Ted Conover, whose agony left him with some permanent marks on his psyche, but no ambivalence about his choice.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. And here's Brooke again with the concluding part of our exploration of the undercover reporting genre.
Ted Conover teaches journalism at New York University. He's also a master of the kind of journalism we've been discussing, the undercover kind. In his case, the kind where a writer sheds the persona of journalist and submerges himself into another way of life. For his book, Rolling Nowhere, he rode freight trains across America with some of the last remaining hobos. In his book, Coyotes, he spent a year with Mexican migrants shuttling across the border. And in New Jack, guarding Sing Sing, he spent nearly a year as a prison guard in Ossining, New York. He says he likes writing where the writer has something at stake, where he doesn't depend too heavily on experts, but rather has had time to think and research and transform himself into an expert, where the urgency of the subject can transform the writing into something that matters, an act of witnessing. 10 years ago, he had the urge to become that kind of expert on prison.
First thought was, well, could I be incarcerated? And the answer is yes, but then could I stop being incarcerated when I wanted to? And the answer is probably no. I thought a really interesting way to write about it would be through the perspective of guards, through correction officers. So I got assigned by the New Yorker to write about a family of officers upstate. I thought all by itself, that's interesting that generations of people work in the same prison. And got permission to visit one prison where a family I had met worked, but then I couldn't go back and they wouldn't let me see them talking to inmates or doing the job. I'd heard about the Corrections Academy in Albany, which is a 2-month training facility, and I thought that would be interesting to see how the values of the profession are instilled in raw recruits. That could be great to watch somebody go through. And they said, oh, we never let journalists into that. And they acted like it was the CIA. But in fact, the Department of Correctional Services is the largest employer in New York State after Verizon. At that point, I thought I had passed a test for no longer declaring what I planned to do. I thought I am going to take the corrections officer exam And I took it. And I didn't lie on the application. I had done lots of menial jobs to support myself as a writer. I listed all of them. So I got hired.
How did you prepare yourself beyond the actual training?
You know, the training gives you good preparation for being yelled at all day by angry men who are stronger than you and for being intimidated, because that's kind of what it's about. You're in a place where people dislike you because of your uniform. You're outnumbered. And yet there are certain standards of conduct you have to maintain. And mainly they try to teach you not to lose your temper, because it's when you lose your temper that bad things happen. If you can just control yourself and not get angry and not look scared, things are usually okay.
You said that letting the prisoners out of their cells for meals felt like opening Pandora's box. Can you talk about a specific day when something really went wrong?
There were so many. Probably the worst day was the day I lost my temper. I had a trainee. I'd been there now 7 or 8 months, and she was sent to find out where everyone was going after lunch. You go to the gym, you go to the school to work on your GED, you go to the yard, and somebody has to fill out a form. She did that, and an inmate exposed himself and worse to her, and she came back looking just destroyed, and I got so angry at that guy, I went down and just yelled at him, the top of my lungs, basically. And everybody got so excited, mocking me, and I took the mirror of a guy who was using it to see when I was coming. But the next time I went by, he somehow both spit on me and swung at me at the same time and got me right behind the ear and knocked me over. And I wasn't hurt, but I was humiliated, because being a CO is all about control. And the whole cell block was whooping and shouting. And it was days until I realized that the real injury I suffered was the way I felt about all inmates as I drove home that day. I hated all those guys.
You wrote that prison was full of frustration and very little catharsis. And the more you did the job, the more you longed for the use of force.
Absolutely true. And that particular day, I went and told the sergeant what happened. And his first question to me was, he swung at you out of his cell? I said, yeah. He said, why didn't you break his arm? And the thought had occurred to me, you've got this amazing leverage of having bars between the body and the end of the arm. I could have broken his arm. And such was my state that the thought was very appealing. And that's kind of nasty, isn't it? That's kind of sick. But it has a logic in prison. I did not get to exercise any force that day. He did. He felt great. I felt like a fool.
What was the most surprising thing you learned as a new Jack?
One of the most surprising things is that I could react that way as a college-educated person who's empathetic and, you know, I thought that wouldn't happen to me. I never understood why people in prison could act the way they do. You know, you figure, oh, there's just something unhealthy in the air, but it's built into the very architecture of a prison. Who gets to move around? Who's stuck in their box? The mechanisms of locking and gates, the dehumanizing effect of that on the majority of residents of a prison, and then the corresponding dehumanization of the person who has power over them.
You are isolated from the people you were working with because they didn't know really who you were. And you are isolated from your wife because she knew who you were but didn't know what you were experiencing. Can you talk a little bit about how that affected you?
I think it's almost a fixed characteristic of any undercover experience, especially a stressful one, which I imagine most of them are. During this time, I watched Donnie Brasco, the movie about an informant. I think he's an FBI informant with the mob. And like all such stories, I mean, people know this, that it messes up your life, right? You start drinking too much. Maybe you do some of those drugs. Instead of coming home to take care of your kid and help your wife with the dishes, you stay out late and you
decompress.
Yes, or
worse.
Veer off in the wrong direction, right? And it was no different for me. I wanted to spare my family the dirtiness of that job. I felt like I brought home a smell. I remember one day Sing Sing has these long, dark corridors. And I was walking with another officer between two gates, and I slipped. And we looked down, and I had slipped in a pool of blood. Because almost every day at Sing Sing, a prisoner was stabbing another one. That's kind of creepy. I'd never had that happen
you
before.
Think?
And I should have gone home and said, honey, well, it was a good day, but I slipped in blood, and that's why my pants look this way. But I took them off. I washed them. I didn't want her to know. And that, I think in retrospect, that's not the right way to handle it, you know? But mm-hmm. that is how I handled it.
So it's incredibly stressful and difficult work, but it's also kind of exciting, isn't it? Nobody knows who you are. You're writing about them. You're leading a double life. There's an element of subversion to all of this.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's how you keep going back, because every day you're seeing something none of your friends have ever seen and that most people in society don't know about. I was wearing two hats at the same time. I mean, the guard was by far what occupied my consciousness and everything else most of the day, because that was so demanding. But at some level, I was also thinking, wow, I've got to write that down. Then I could step into this little office I had. It was a cell converted to it had a desk instead of a bunk. And I'd write down like a joke. How many COs does it take to push an inmate down the stairs?
How many?
None. He fell. Okay. So I would write that down. I'd write down slang. I'd write down stuff that I knew I'd want to put into my notes. And so, yes, that is exciting to think I am just seeing amazing things. And the telling of this, it's going to be really satisfying to be able to stop someday and put all this down.
What do you say to the criticisms that there is no story worth misrepresenting yourself for?
Well, first of all, was I a guard? Yes. I was not an imposter in terms of my determination to do a good job, to do an honorable job, to do a job by the rules, to put myself on the line for the people around me the way they were doing for me. Did I fully expect to quit? Yes. Did I fully expect when I quit to write about it? Yes. Did I fully expect that some of these people I worked with would be surprised to hear that all along I'd been planning to write about it? Yes. All of that is true. But I didn't approach this particular project thinking, I'm going to go get the goods on those people, which would be one way to approach it, and not necessarily a bad way. I'm not saying it would be impossible to do that in an ethical fashion. If there was a prison, say, which was notorious, you know, which was corrupt, where bad things were happening, could a journalist feel justified in sneaking in there under false pretenses to see what was going on? I think so. I think the public has an interest in knowing, and I think that would be okay. This particular project I thought would be more interesting if I could go beyond expose to showing what it was like to do this work. So I talk about every single bad thing I saw. Everyone asked me, why don't you talk about prison rape? Well, believe me, I looked for it everywhere I thought I might find it. That's what everybody wants to know, and that's what they expect from the movies. I didn't find it. I heard about it occasionally. I wrote about that. But I didn't want to be tabloid. I thought this is going to be so interesting all by itself, just in the day-to-day examination of what it was like to do the work.
And you were sincere in your work, even as you observed and you wrote about it. On the other hand, you do describe a situation where it seems as if you felt that you might be exposed, that your cover might be blown, and therefore you had a cover.
It's true. As in so many situations when you do journalism, you don't go into every situation disclosing everything about yourself, okay? It's not just journalism. Whether you're a doctor or a salesman or a lawyer, whatever, you don't go into every situation and blurt out absolutely everything that might interest the person you're about to interact with. Now, as a journalist, does it behoove you to disclose the fact that you're a journalist? Yes, under ordinary circumstances, that's what I do. That's what I teach students to do. But there are circumstances where it's impossible if you hope to find out something important. So can that be justified in certain circumstances? I think it can. I know there are those who disagree. I was written about in the LA Times when my book came out, and the reporter called somebody from the Poynter Institute, which is like the journalist superego, as you know, down in Florida,
exactly.
looking to make sure we all dot our I's and cross our T's in an ethical fashion. And his comment was, well, if Conover's co-workers didn't know the whole story about him, how can we as readers know he's telling the truth to us? And to me, that's a non sequitur. One doesn't lead to the other. My writing is true. It's fact-checked. It's honest. I tell what's really on my mind. Can you believe me? Well, I hope so. And I think most readers have shown that they do.
Would you do this again? I mean, in New Jack, I was frankly astonished to learn that after your 9 months, you were up to take another test and you wanted to take it. And your wife evidently said, are you nuts? It stops here.
They only offer the sergeant exam every 5 years. Was I going to let that opportunity slip by? I mean, who knows? This is the way I was thinking at the time. We don't know what life will bring us. I mean, look right now, the stock market crashing around us. I've always, as a freelance, felt the sort
of... You are looking as prison guard as a career to fall back on?
Well, it's a steady job, and I seem to do an okay job at it. And I thought, well, with a sergeant salary, I'd, you know... It's nuts. Of course it's nuts. But that's where my head was. And when she gave me a little shake, I was happy. But some part of me still thought, well, it couldn't hurt just to sign up. You know, it's funny. It's like Keats said, you hold two opposing ideas in your head at the same time. And one is that I'm a CO, and the other is that I'm a writer. I'm a journalist. And we all have multiple roles. I just like to think if a journalist is imaginative, he or she can find some unusual kinds of roles that have to do with the conduct of our nation. And if you have enough forbearance to put up whatever that job's going to require, that can be pretty interesting.
Do you have anything else in mind?
I have a few ideas, but I can't tell you.
You'd have to break my arm.
I wouldn't do that to you, Brooke.
Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Ted Conover teaches narrative nonfiction at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute.
We originally aired Brooke's conversation with Ted Conover in October 2008. Senator Edward Kennedy's hometown paper, The Boston Globe, commenced an editorial page obituary with a startling line. Ted Kennedy was not a great man. We'll leave that conclusion for others to debate. What the words reflected, though, and synthesized, was a 47-year public career in which the youngest Kennedy brother lived out an ongoing metamorphosis. From ingenue of dubious gravitas...
Another Kennedy has thrown his hat into the national political arena. Edward M. or Ted officially announces
to
his campaign
accidental, eloquent paterfamilias.
On behalf of Mrs. Kennedy, her children, the parents and sisters of Robert Kennedy, I want to express what we feel to those who mourn with us today.
To cowardly, negligent embarrassment.
There is no truth whatever, to the widely circulated suspicions of immoral conduct that have been leveled at my behavior and hers regarding that evening.
To presidential candidate.
Today I formally announce that I'm a candidate for President of the United States.
To drunken caricature.
Remember, if anyone asked, you're my niece from out of town.
I am your niece, Uncle Joe.
Good Lord, I'm an abomination.
To liberal standard bearer.
Mr. Bork should also be rejected by the Senate, because he stands for an extremist view of the Constitution and the role of the Supreme Court.
To Lion of the Senate.
I will be there next January on the floor of the United States Senate.
All played out in the media for a public endlessly intrigued by the epic exploits, tragic fates, and tragic flaws of America's most enduring political dynasty. Now the tragic, comic, appalling, inspiring, above all, epic odyssey has come to an end, with all the media attention befitting the last male Kennedy of his generation. As to the question of greatness, it is a subject that the senator himself considered, in 1968 in eulogizing his martyred brother, Robert. Perhaps this is the passage the editors of the Globe had in mind.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it.
Edward M. Kennedy died this week at the age of 77. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, with more help from Kasia Glotke and Sarah Fidelibus. Sarah, thanks so much for your time here. Good luck teaching this semester. The show was edited this week by, give or take, me. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. Thank God. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.